Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblom. In March, we'll hear about today's invasion of drummers from around the globe as we celebrate the Iowa Days of Percussion. We'll ponder if old master painters still exist. We'll learn about an international guitarist who is appearing as part of the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's concert series. And we'll catch up with the Johnson County Landmark Band as they prepare to bring an incredible saxophonist and ethnomusicologist to the state for a lecture and a concert. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
If you're able to come, please do so. Please come on out, not only to support your community, but just to come out and see something different. Get out of the house a little bit, you know, dress up, put on your snazzes on, and come out, listen to some good music and fellowship with us. Because as I'm going through and reading the bio of Melvin and seeing what's going on, I mean, this obviously is an event not to be missed. Please come on out and just take part of this experience, this show, and come on out and support the program, and hopefully we'll see you guys there.
Courtney Jones, University of Iowa's visiting assistant professor of the Johnson County Landmark Band. Dr. Jones stepped in temporarily this semester as the director of UI's JCL Jazz Ensemble for John Rapson, who's on sabbatical. On Friday, April 1st, the Johnson County Landmark Band will perform in concert at the Riverside Recital Hall in Iowa City. An amazing guest ethnomusicologist and saxophonist will be joining the JCL on stage.
Who we have coming in is Melvin Butler, and Melvin Butler is a phenomenal musician, and it's an interesting story that I'm going to tell of how John and Melvin met. But Melvin Butler is the assistant professor of music at University of Chicago, and he is an ethnomusicologist that has, you know, broad interests in music and the religion of the African diaspora. But the interesting fact about this is that Melvin, he's an ethnomusicologist, and he's also a jazz musician, and they're separated. He has his jazz that he plays with Brian Blade Fellowship Band. I mean, I think he started with that band back in 2000. And then when he's not performing, he's teaching in the academic side as a established and accredited lecturer in ethnomusicology and music. And Brian Blade, who is the drummer's drummer, you know, he's an individual who's played with Wayne Shorter, Joni Mitchell, Kenny Garrett, and Bob Dylan. And he's the type of individual that shows that sensitivity in his surroundings and musical surroundings. An interesting story about how Melvin and John met. So John, he was in Haiti in 2006, where he was doing a festival down there, this summer festival. And in his band was sitting Melvin Butler. And so while he's working with these kids that were there, he just kind of like, man, who is this guy? Where are you from? What's happening? And it was evidently Melvin Butler. Interesting enough, at that time, because Melvin was there doing research on his PhD, Melvin's teacher, Gage Averwall, who at the time was teaching at New York University, was also John's teacher at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. So you have that connection, right? Gage's primary area was anthropology and the music of Haiti and the culture. And so not thinking that, okay, these two had anything else in common or they would ever meet again. Years later, Melvin was doing a lecture series at the University of Washington in Seattle at the Society of Ethnomusicology. And he was doing a lecture series on gospel music. And John's friend that went to school with him at the University of Wesleyan, Dr. Michael Webb, who teaches at the Sydney Consortium, had sent John an email and said, hey man, you have got to check this guy out. His name is Melvin Butler. And John was like, wait a minute, why do I know this name? And it didn't dawn on him that he had met Melvin years ago when they were in Haiti. So it's interesting how things happen for a reason, you know, how years apart that they would be introduced to this individual. So after that, John just had to figure out a way to get Melvin down to the University of Iowa, and he did it. And Melvin will be playing on April 1st.
Tell us about what some of the things you have planned for this festival, because the Johnson County Landmark Band is going to be involved, and Melvin's going to be giving some lectures. There's going to be performances. A whole host of things are going to happen.
Yeah, so basically, it's going to be a weekend of just music. But as far as what Melvin's part is, Melvin is going to be giving a lecture. Most of his work centers on the cultural politics of musical style and on the creative strategies through which spiritually charged music making is embedded in the process of social boundary crossing in the Caribbean. And so it can be a mixture of things that he could talk about. He could talk about improvisations, or he can talk about some of the things that he's spoken about or written about. And right now he's presently completing two book manuscripts. One is titled Claiming Haiti, Music, Christianity, and the Politics of Transcendence, which focuses on the continuum of Protestant Christian practices in Haiti and the disclosures of cultural authenticity and nationalism and the defined favor that inflect congregational worship. And the other one is Goodbye World, Music Flow and Pentecostal Identity in Jamaica, which examines the musical and theological connections between Jamaica and African-American forms of ritual practice. So you see there's a combination here of music and spirituality that Melvin just loves to research. And I'm pretty sure that he's going to talk something similar to those conceptual ideologies. And in regards to the concert that's going to happen on the 1st that evening, you're going to hear the Johnson County Landmark. We're going to be doing a couple of pieces of new music. We're going to be doing a tune of his, A Better Day. And we're also going to be doing Seasons of Change that was recorded with Melvin with the Brian Blade Fellowship Band. And you hear that, you're going to hear Melvin work with the ensemble, and you're going to see him perform in a combo setting as well as a big band setting, and having a interplay with the students as well as the ensembles. Some of the tunes you're going to hear: Bloom by Asuka Kakitami. You're going to hear West Point by Michael Conrad, which oddly enough is an Iowa native who went to the University of Northern Iowa, and he came here during, I guess, the summer jazz camps that's held on by the jazz department here. And he's finishing his doctorate at the University of Northern Colorado in Greenlee. So that's kind of like a mixture of like showcasing the family that's here and the pool of talent that's happening. You also have Concert in the Garden, written by Maria Schweiner. That will feature Jim Buning and Blake Shaw, Jim is a graduate student, so is Blake Shaw, is a graduate student here at the University of Iowa, including featuring that with Melvin Butler on that. So it's a combination of both soloists, combo, and big band music, presenting the music of a contemporary idiom and concept of which is near and dear to John's heart, and what's going to showcase Melvin Butler. And the lecture and the performances are, they're all on the same day, April 1st. And the performance is at 7:30 p.m. in Riverside Recital Hall, and the lecture is at 1:30 p.m. in the choral room at CSM 5, which is directly across the street from the new music building.
University of Iowa's visiting assistant professor of Johnson County Landmark Band, Dr. Courtney Jones. Both the University of Iowa's lecture and the Johnson County Landmark Band concert, featuring soloist Dr. Melvin Butler on April 1st, are free and open to the public. To hear Courtney speak more about the University of Iowa jazz bands, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. To get more details about the University of Iowa School of Music events, please go to arts.uiowa.edu/events/music. Just ahead, you'll hear the inside scoop on how the 40,000-square-foot State Historical Museum with around 100,000 objects can still squeeze in another exhibit. You'll discover details about an upcoming recital for the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's concert series. And you'll learn about a remarkable opportunity today to see and hear percussion instruments from around the world performed by international percussionists. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
this is really a very unique event. It's not often that we have the opportunity to have this many different international musicians all in one location. You know, we have those from the United States and Iowa and Hungary and Ukraine and Italy and Luxembourg and France and Canada, Asian countries, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I think that's just a spectacular attraction, a very exciting event to think about all of that. Now, for us, what really tops it off is that they're all percussionists. I mean, is there any other thing that could be more exciting or better than that?
Of course there's something better, because we have so many premieres and new pieces. You know, what's great about this program is it offers something to everybody. The seasoned pros and the beginners, people that have no experience in percussion, will see all kinds of things that are new. And those that are professionals are going to find new pieces and find new connections in the community.
The University of Northern Iowa's Professor of Percussion, Randy Hogenkamp, and UNI's Instructor of Percussion, Matthew Andrini. Randy and Matt, who have been planning this event for over 2 years, are co-directing this year's 2016 Iowa Days of Percussion at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn, being hosted by the UNI School of Music and UNI Percussion. While yesterday the Iowa Days of Percussion featured middle and high school ensembles, today's events feature college and university performers along with professional percussionists. In addition to the England-based Maraca II percussion duo and their World Percussion Group performance ensemble, the festival will also showcase the Iowa-Hungary Percussion Project, of which Matt is one of the founding members.
My duo that I run, the Iowa-Hungary Percussion Project, with my colleague in Hungary, Gábor Palotás, we're also performing as part of this, so I'm involved in that aspect pretty significantly as well. Gábor will be arriving a week before, and we'll have about a week of rehearsal time, and we'll be giving 3 premieres of new pieces that we've commissioned specifically for this program.
And let's just briefly mention that this World Percussion Group is like an international group that were auditioned.
It was very competitive. There are individuals and groups that are coming to our event from the United States, from Canada, I mean, literally from all over the world. So it'll have an international flavor, that's for sure.
Tell us about your lineup today that's geared today for colleges and universities and also professional percussionists.
So in the morning, University of Northern Iowa will have a short program. There'll be a group coming from Iowa Central Community College. The University of Iowa will have a presentation, and Iowa State University Ensemble will also play Saturday morning. Right before noon, we're planning to have a feature performance by the collective group of the World Percussion Group. And then in the afternoon, it's primarily individual clinics. There'll be clinics running on the hour at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. The Iowa Hungary Duo is at 2 p.m., and they've got a very special program.
We have 3 commissions for this season, but our primary project for this concert involves an Iowan composer, Brooke Joyce, who teaches at Luther College. And we commissioned him to write a piece for a women's choir with 2 percussionists. And this will be the world premiere of it on Saturday. And then on Sunday, we'll be performing it at Luther with their college. We'll also have 2 solo works that we've commissioned by Hungarian composers, which will premiere. So on Saturday, our performance is with the UNI Women's Choir. And then on Sunday at Luther College, we're going to perform with a women's choir from Luther College. So we're going to have a different choir for each performance, actually, that we're working with.
Tell us a little bit about that work.
The work is called In Memoriam Eus. So we commissioned this piece, and we specifically asked him to write based on a text that he felt was appropriate. And we specifically asked for a 5-octave marimba part and a part for a vibraphonist. We did allow him to add a couple of small instruments. So we have a single chime note and a pair of bongos. And the marimba player also comes over and plays the vibraphone for a little bit. We share the instrument. But primarily, we have our own stations. We ask for these requests because we know that we tour a lot with these pieces, and we're planning to do them as well in June in Hungary. And we know how difficult it is to travel with these instruments, so we try to keep a short list and be very specific.
So tell us about the other two world premieres that you're going to be presenting.
The other two premieres that we have are solo works that we've commissioned by Hungarian composers. The first is a piece by Balázs Horváth. And Balázs wrote a piece called Bean. And if any of you are familiar with the comedian Mr. Bean, this is based on a skit that he did. And it's a theatrical work for solo percussionists. It involves some pantomiming and acting. I'll be assisting in this performance. So the second work we're premiering is another duo for vibraphone and marimba. And it's by a Hungarian composer named Máté Szigeti. Máté is a very young composer, and he's now studying in Scotland, and he wrote this piece based on his studies, and it's called The List of Orkney Islands in Alphabetical Order. And it's another piece for marimba and vibraphone, two players, and basically it goes through the various landscapes that he sees from these islands. And he goes through the characters and the bare landscape and the ocean and all of these characteristics that he sees.
So you have three world premieres, and then you have these other workshops. And then what else is in conjunction with this Iowa Days of Percussion on Saturday?
Well, on Saturday night, we're collaborating with the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony and with our guest artist, Maraca Two, having them perform a double percussion concerto on the Waterloo Symphony concert that evening. It's by Avner Dorman, and it's called Spices, Perfumes, and Toxins. And it's a very mixed ensemble in terms of percussion instruments. You know, lots of keyboards, lots of drums. Very colorful, interesting, rhythmic piece. So that will be kind of a nice highlight culminating all of the daytime events to have the Maraca II ensemble perform with the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony.
Tell us just briefly a little bit more about this Dorman piece, because it uses a lot of world percussion sounds in it.
Oh, yeah. It's even to the point that I know finding some of the instruments has been a challenge for the soloists, and we've been helping out as much as we can. But there are instruments like darbukas, and those are essentially Middle Eastern hourglass-shaped drums, single-headed drums, and I think each performer needs two of those, and pretty much the setup is a mirror, you know, from one to the other. They're both playing similar kinds of setups, but just colorful and rhythmic and, you know, very exciting and interesting. And I think the title says a lot, you know, Spices, Perfumes, and Toxins. I mean, what does that suggest?
University of Northern Iowa's professor of percussion, Randy Hogenkamp, and UNI's instructor of percussion, Matthew Andrini. For more information about today's 2016 Iowa Days of Percussion at UNI's Gallagher Bluedorn, please go to uni.edu/music/events. To hear more from Randy and Matt's interview about today's events and an upcoming 50 years of UNI percussion concert, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Tonight's performance of Dorman's Spices, Perfumes, and Toxins with the WCF Symphony features percussionists Jason Huxtable and Garrett Mendelau. The WCF concert starts at 7:30 tonight at the Gallagher Bluedorn. For more details and tickets, go to wcfsymphony.org. Tickets will also be available for sale at the door. Also tonight, Ames Town and Gown will be presenting soprano Roberta Alexander in concert at the Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall on the ISU campus at 7:30. Don't go away. You'll catch details about the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's approaching concert. And you'll discover the creative inspiration behind the stunning and vibrant Portrait of Makokada, the Dimensional View exhibit, opening on March 11th at the State Historical Museum. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
One thing I didn't expect about giving the gift of this to our town is I didn't realize that in reality I was getting the biggest gift by sitting across from all these people who maybe I'd seen in the grocery store or walking or somewhere, but I didn't really know them, and spending 4 or 5 hours with them. I like to say that I intended to give something to my community, not knowing how much the community would give to me. And really because spending time with somebody and really living for that period in their world and in their continents, right into their face, into their impressions, and into what they're able to share, really sort of changes your life when you really open yourself up to another person and allow an exchange to happen. I like to say I had the best seat in the house.
Internationally acclaimed artist and Iowa native Rose Franson. Rose grew up in Maquoketa to a large, hardworking family that valued teamwork. She had a paper route, and everyone was expected to pitch in and help around the house. Even though she didn't know what it fully meant, she knew by the time she was 7 that she wanted to be an artist. Rose started in advertising at the American Academy of Art in Chicago. One of her classmates from Australia convinced her dad to fly Rose down under to paint portraits of her father's parents. Her trip to Australia and a rainy day proved to be major turning points in her life.
Even though I'd only been in oil portraits for like 6 months, she convinced her father that I should be flown out to Australia and paint his parents. And so they flew me out to Australia, and I went to do a portrait commission of his parents. And in that time period, well, there's a whole bunch of things that happened inside of this Australian experience. She was a pretty successful commercial artist and had a really good job in Sydney, Australia. And she went to lunch with another guy who she thought was the best commercial artist in Sydney. And she came back from lunch and she brought him with her to meet me, right? And I was in her office sort of drawing the executives in her firm. And she had this guy meet me. And this guy's looking at my illustrations that I was kind of doing for her and my drawings. And he said, "Do you do anything else?" And I said, "Well, I paint a little bit. I oil paint." And I had 4 photographs of oil paintings that I had done. And he looked at them and he said, "If I could paint like this, I would never be a commercial artist." And right then I made my decision to go fully into fine art. So when I went back to the U.S., I took only fine art classes. And I think I had 4 months or something of schooling left. I just went full on into painting, and I made a personal commitment to be a painter. And I thought, if I'm still starving in 5 years, I'll get a real job. And that's kind of how I began. And then when I finally really thought this is what I want to do, I went full on. And all my other friends, we were all posing for each other. We painted, you know, around the clock, oil painting, but I was also doing watercolors. And I went out on those art fairs and started selling my paintings in art fairs. But I really actually started drawing portraits in those art fairs. And it wasn't until I had a rainy day and I couldn't draw those, you know, those street artist portraits. And when that happened, I couldn't draw because it was too wet. And I sold my first painting. And I realized the reason why I wasn't selling my paintings is because I was always drawing portraits and nobody wanted to interrupt me. So I quit drawing the portraits and just started selling my paintings at the art fair. And then I found a gallery, and then it went on from there.
A lot happened to Rose before she painted her portrait of Maquoketa. She attended the Palette and Chisel Academy with Richard Schmid, went to the Lyme Academy College of Fine Arts, studied anatomy, and married artist Chuck Morris. She and Chuck eventually returned to Maquoketa full-time, and with Rose's parents purchased the former City Hall and made it into a gallery and studio space. Rose had so many things she wanted to accomplish. She thought about how she wanted to regain her alla prima skills, painting an entire portrait from start to finish in 4 to 5 hours. She deliberated about how she could share the magic of painting with people who had never been in a painting or who had ever picked up a brush. Then she had an epiphany.
There's also another thing that was happening. I was asked to be in a show up in Dubuque at the Dubuque Art Museum. And the theme of the show was social commentary. And I had been thinking all kinds of ideas. And, you know, a lot of the social commentary, when you have that as a theme, sort of look at your world critically, you know, and you're like, oh, I'll comment on this thing that I have a problem with or that thing I have a problem with. And I had been getting a bunch of really good ideas that way. But some part of them didn't connect enough with all the other questions that I was kind of living with at the time. And I was on my way to the grocery store thinking about all these things. Oh, I want to get better at alla prima. I want to paint older people. How do you give what you do to your community? How do you help people find this, that day to live lives of meaning and value and nobility, even if it doesn't get flagged like with this sort of, you know, you're an artist label? Or how do you bring that to your community? And I'm walking to the grocery store, and this is what I was thinking about. I was just really wondering what I'm going to say, what I'm going to do, social commentary, and da-da-da-da. And all those questions are kind of going through my brain, and I go through the whole grocery store, and I'm in the checkout line, and I'm standing there, and I look up, and I see all these people around me. There's older people and younger people, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. I should paint my neighbors, right? And as soon as I had that thought pop into my head, all of these different questions, and I think there were like at least seven, I've only mentioned four to you, at least seven lines of questions that I've been sort of exploring in my head, all of a sudden they all clicked into this one idea. I will paint my town in one portrait, right? We'll call it Portrait of Maquoketa. I'm going to paint everybody in town and make one painting of it. And it was like, that's it. That's it. And I went home and I was super excited. My social commentary will be democratizing the portrait. You get painted because you're here, right? And the whole idea is you don't have to be anybody important. You just have to have a desire to participate, which I think is really necessary in a democracy, you know? And so we'll democratize the portrait. You bring yourself to it. You show up. You become part of it. And I'll let anybody who wants to be painted be painted. And so I called my parents up and I asked them, what do you think? They were going to some fundraiser potluck that night. And I said, when you go tonight, ask your friends that you're going to be sitting with at the table if they would be willing to participate in this project, just to get a feeler out. And my folks went. And they called me when they got home, and I said, what did people say? And they said, half the people said they would never let themselves be painted. And when I heard that, I said to myself, oh, okay, so I won't paint all 6,000 Maquoketans. I'll paint 3,000 Maquoketans. And it's kind of funny because I thought I could paint everybody in town. And then I realized, oh, no, no, that's not going to happen. And then I started getting more clear, and I cut my number down to 2,000 people. And then I had a brother who's more mathematically adept, and I came back from Maquoketa, and he said, do you know how long it'll take you to paint 2,000 portraits? He said, you'll be painting portraits for 4 or 5 years if you do one a day, if you do this. And I'm like, oh, man. So I started looking into a grant. So another friend in the Dubuque show told me that Iowa Arts Council has grants for projects, and she thought that my project could get a grant. And so we downloaded the grant information right away that afternoon after I got the idea at the grocery store. And I started reading what that grant requirements were. And the more I read the grant requirements, the more the project formulated. The grant process was so wonderful in helping the project become more community-centric. Like, it made me say, where would I paint it? How will I serve? How will people be more involved? Deciding to even apply for the grant created, I think, some of the fundamental characteristics of the project that really made it successful, you know. And that was, how's the outreach? How are you going to invite people to do it? Who's going to come in? Who gets to be part of it? Where are you going to do it? And all of that information came within like the next 36 hours because the grant was due in 2 days. And so it sort of harmonized my entire project, and all these questions kind of got answered. And even the number of how many portraits I could do, I put in there, and I thought I could do like 500. Not really aware that how long 500 would even take me, because I wound up only doing 180 in the year that I spent working on that project, which when people find out that I painted 180 portraits in a year, they're kind of shocked. Artists who find out, they're like, you did 180 portraits in a year? And I'm like, yeah, I know. I thought I could do 500, but I couldn't. It just didn't understand the physics of it, like how physically demanding it would be to paint different people every day, you know, and boom, start fresh. Another painting, another painting, another painting, you know. But we did 180 in the year. The grant really helped me. Didn't get the full grant that I applied for. They just gave me like 2/3 of the money that I asked for. But it was enough of a starter, and it was enough of a mental formulation that it really, really was essential. I think without the state of Iowa having that grant process, I don't think this project ever would have come into being. I think it would have fallen apart right in the initial stages. I don't think it would have formulated so quickly and had such a solid beginning. So that's kind of how that project kind of came about.
Rose developed several unique techniques to capture her portraits. Maquoketa residents were asked to sign up for a time without many extra details about themselves. Rose did the rest.
In the Portrait Maquoketa project, I was meeting these people visually in this room for the first time, cold. Only thing I knew about each person was a name. I knew that they lived in Maquoketa, the decade in which they were born. Like if they were 20, I knew that they were between 10 and 20. I didn't have anybody tell me their exact age unless they wanted to. So everybody was aligned by are you between 10 and 20, between 50 and 60. So I knew what decade they might be in, and I knew if they were male or female. That is it. So every day, I had to have a way when they walked in to sort of figure out how I was going to paint them. And also, they had never posed before. So I needed a way to paint somebody who's never had that experience of posing. That means they really can't hold still like a professional model, and they didn't really expect to hold still like a professional model. And I didn't want them to feel like they needed to do that either, eventually, that they had to hold perfectly still. Because I think it's an experience which scared a lot of people from actually signing up to have their portrait painted, thinking that they would have to be really still for a super long time and wouldn't be able to do it. They thought, oh, I wiggle too much or da-da-da-da. So I had to have a painting approach that allowed a moving target who I didn't know and didn't expect to come in and start painting. And so I have this way where I start painting, believe it or not, the forehead. In just painting a person's forehead, I start to see the color of their skin in the forehead. And I let that be my kind of my entrance, and then I move from there. I start maybe with one eye and get the other eye. So it's like they're puzzle pieces. The first piece of the puzzle is the skin color of the forehead, and the second piece of the puzzle might be the eyebrows, and I just sort of put these pieces of puzzle on top of each other. After I did my first, like, 20 or 30, I started letting people watch the whole thing in a mirror because I quit being rusty in the a la prima approach. And when people saw their forehead come in, fine. And then they saw one eye. And as soon as people saw one of their eyes show up on the canvas and the rest of the canvas is this white surface, they started to see themselves somewhat appear. And I kind of began to capture their attention a little bit more. Like they started to see, hey, this painting is happening of me too. We're not just having this conversation. And so then I would move to the other eye. And by the time I got to their nose, people were really able to see themselves sort of emerging out of this white canvas. So that would be how I started. And when I teach it, I call it my fail-safe approach that you can use with a moving target. You get something you can trust. We call it an anchor when I teach. You anchor in something that you can say, okay, there's the shape of their forehead. There's that first eye. And every time they move and they get lost and they start telling me a story, I just look at that eye and I wait them to come back to somewhat of the position, and then I will put the next piece of information in. So there's their eyebrow. There's their nostril. And I just wait and I put it in. But I use this sort of anchor and allow them to move around.
It sounds really cool. I wish
it is really cool. And we have this book of the project. We had realized we hadn't really photographed any of the process, or we didn't film very much. We didn't photograph it. And we're near the end of the year of the project, and it occurred to us maybe we should photograph me painting a couple of people's portraits. And so Chuck came in, my husband came in, and he set up a camera behind me and photographed every 7 minutes. And so in our book that we have of the project, we have in the right-hand corner, it's almost like a flip book, you can see every 7 minutes what I did, like how much was done every 7 minutes. And the person, you can sort of see them emerge out of this white canvas. And I have a funny story about that. So the kids are watching me. They can see their painting happening in the mirror. And I would always leave a chunk of their face white, because if the kids saw their entire face just flesh colored, if I put pink scanner, yellow scanner, all over where their face might be, they kind of thought they were done. So I would always leave white, like in a chunk of their face, so it was as if part of it was missing. Well, I got their ears in, and I found out where their neck went, and maybe where their shoulders were, so they wouldn't feel like they didn't have to sit anymore. And little kids would say, when are you going to get rid of the shaving cream? can you take the shaving cream off my pain? Because the little white spot on their face, they could see themselves, and they thought that it looked like they had shaving cream left. And it was just sort of a trick I did to keep kids sitting in the chair longer. I wound up developing all kinds of tricks to keep kids and adults sort of staying there with me in the room without needing to leave. That was kind of fun. But in the book, you can kind of see them emerging off of the white canvas. And there's this one where you can sort of see there's still a piece of shaving cream right on his chin. And then finally the shaving cream's gone, and I'm getting his neck and his background in all the way. He was 11, though, so I didn't need to trick him too much. He was willing to sit pretty well. Yeah, it was fun how that happened. As an artist, you kind of need a lot of different approaches for different situations. And this is my moving target approach. It's like a sort of open, patient kind of looking and watching. And that's what I did with Portia Makokura. So knowing that they would probably be moving and talking to me and not holding still, I would have this one place. I knew that eye. Once I got that eye in, everything was sort of painted itself from there.
The artist and creator, Rose Franzen, speaking about her portrait of Makokura, The Dimensional View. The executive director of Davenport's Figge Museum, Tim Schiffer, expands on the next chapter in Rose's Portrait of Makokura project.
So she did these 180 portraits, and she showed the whole group at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington. And then she came back, and she and her husband, Chuck Morris, kind of had this idea of taking the whole project to the next level. So they built these tall, narrow panels, and Rose painted a panorama of the town of Makokura on these panels. And then the panels hang from the ceiling in kind of three tiers, in kind of an arch. And the portraits, which are 12 inches square, are set into the backs of these panels. So from one side of this artwork, you see these hanging like strips of these portraits of all the people in Makokura. And from the other side, you see this beautiful kind of fall landscape of the town. And then Rose's brother happens to be a very well-known composer, and he composed an audio element that's kind of playing over your head about people kind of murmuring about Makokura. So it's like an environment. It's more than just a painting. It's kind of a painted environment. And you can walk in between the panels. So it's just very unique. And when we showed it here in 2013, there was just a lot of interest in trying to give it a home because it's big. It takes a 40-foot square gallery, which is pretty big. So it really is a museum piece that needs to be cared for in a museum setting. And, you know, it needs crates and hanging apparatus and everything. So, you know, we had some really generous donors that helped us acquire the painting, and Rose was really good in working with us on that. And the idea was that it was something that the Figge could send out into the world as kind of this artwork that epitomizes the small town Midwest, which Makokura is very typical, you know. So Des Moines, the Historical Society, is our first test of taking Makokura on the road. And so we've constructed this hanging apparatus for it, and we're very excited to show it in Des Moines and to show it at the Historical Museum, which is the home of the Iowa Arts Council and the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, which support us and so many organizations. We're just very excited to see it there and to be able to kind of take this experience out on the road. And we're hoping that it will travel, you know, all over. And so it's really beautiful. You know, it's really heartfelt. And people they just love it, you know.
The Figge Museum's executive director, Tim Schiffer. On loan from the Figge Art Museum, Rose Franzen's amazing portrait of Makokura, The Dimensional View with Hanging Panels and Audio, will open on Friday, March 11th at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. In conjunction with the exhibit, the State Historical Museum is presenting between March 14th and the 18th a whole host of hands-on spring break events. The state curator, Leo Landis, and exhibits manager, Andrew Harrington, fill us in on the details.
So the week of spring break, Monday, March 14th through Friday, March 18th, we have several things going on. We have some different activities for families to do with children. So on Monday, we have an activity where, and not just children, anyone, adults, children, they can do abstract self-portraits of themselves. And then each day, we also include vault tours for 20 people. You can register for those in advance at iowahistory.org. And then we will also have a green screen activity set up where you can take your photo in front of this green screen. And then we found historical photos, many from Maquoketa, actually, where you actually are being inserted into the photo. So that's a fun activity. Then on Tuesday and Thursday, we have someone from the portrait studio who will come in and sketch visitors' portraits. And that will actually happen in the gallery space with Portrait of Maquoketa. So you can stop in on Tuesday or Thursday and have your portrait drawn. And then on Wednesday, we will have an activity where you can create a landscape from torn paper, not using any scissors, but just tearing paper and creating any landscape you'd like. And then Friday, we'll be doing family portraits where families can stop in, they can draw each other, and then attach their drawings to each other to form a display.
Well, that all sounds really like cool things to do. Now, you mentioned this vault tour. So what is a vault tour?
This is Leo. Our vault tours are the behind-the-scenes tours that we offer of the permanent collections of the State Museum. Since Maquoketa is the seat of Jackson County, we're going to feature on the spring break vault tours some artifacts from Jackson County, including one of the major employers through the time that Rose was growing up was a company called Clinton Engines. So we'll feature a lot of great Iowa artifacts, but also a number of Jackson County artifacts. And it's usually about an hour-long experience where we talk about highlights and why we do what we do at the State Historical Museum.
And then this history photo booth, this is kind of the same thing, but you're using historical photographs?
Right. We use photographs from the collections of the State Historical Society's archives and our research center to show different scenes of either towns in Iowa or events in Iowa. So you can pick from a number of different images and have your photo taken in front of a historic image and then email it to yourself so that you can use it in social media or any other way you'd like.
Well, Leo, tell us, what does a state curator do, and why is an exhibit like this so important, and what would you like to have people know about it?
It's a way that democratizes the act of having your portrait done, and that's why it's marvelous about Rose's project, is not everyone has the talent that Rose does, but that she came back to Iowa after working in New York and Chicago and thought of a way that she could contribute her talents to the people of her community. So by offering to paint anyone in the community from a three-day-old to a 99-year-old, you have this broad cross-section of Iowans, and we often rely on photographs. And here's an archive, a document, a visual document of the people of Maquoketa. And it's a town with a great story, like so many Iowa towns. It was, you know, stable through most of the early 20th century, and then this business, Clinton Engines, comes in right after World War II as the economy's taking off. And so the town gains 1,500 people in population, and the community really is thriving through that period. And then, like so many Iowa towns, the Clinton Engine factory closes down in the early 70s, so you get this little bit of declension, though it does keep its population right around 6,000 people even to today. So the after effect of the company coming in still keeps the population up. And so Rose being able to document all those people and with the archives that have been created in connection with it is really going to be a great resource, not just for Iowans to appreciate today, but a fabulous resource in the future as people want to see what was Maquoketa, Iowa, and a county seat town in Iowa like in the year 2005, 2006. So it's really a benefit to our whole state, and it's wonderful that the FIGI has taken this into their collection and that can be appreciated at the State Historical Museum in our case, and we're really pleased to be able to offer it to the people of Iowa as well. And a state curator's role is to seek out and work with my colleagues at the State Museum those stories that every Iowan can at least find a bit of themselves in, and I think that's a little bit of what Rose has done. Is even if you aren't one of the people in the portrait of Maquoketa, she's captured the likenesses of everyday Iowans, and we all can see ourselves in those images. And that's what's marvelous about her work, is that it adds some light onto our state when we're sometimes seen as a little bit conservative in our tastes. Here's a classically trained artist who's showing the real talents of an everyday Iowan who went on to do great things.
Well, I don't know if Rose is such an everyday Iowan.
She started out as an everyday Iowan. She just chose to make, you know, follow her talents. And I think that's the story we all can draw, is that, you know, if you put your mind to it and you work hard and enhance your talents. And she had challenges in her life where her family was, you know, pretty middle class, just like a lot of Iowans, maybe a little, you know, more struggling sometimes, as she might say, than she understood as a child. And yet she went on to do something fabulous. And I think that's a lesson we all can draw.
Are you going to have any other activities?
We do plan for Rose to come in, hopefully in the month of June. And we're not quite sure exactly what she'll be doing for us, but she does oftentimes do some portrait work or some painting work there. So hopefully that will happen, but that will be sometime in June.
And another program that we'll be offering later as part of this, we have a partnership with a conservator, a restoration specialist, Barry Bauman, and he's based out of Chicago. He has his own studio. Our conservator, Pete Sixby, has been taking artwork to him since the early 2000s, and Barry donates his time. It only costs the people of Iowa the cost of the materials to restore some of the artwork in our collection. So he'll be coming in and talking about the process of restoring, from a conservation standpoint, some of the artwork that we have in the collection, and he's just a fabulous talent.
So how can folks get more information and details about this Portrait of Maquoketa exhibit?
You can go to iowahistory.org to learn about its run at the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Rose has her own site that talks about the project as well. It's the oldcityhallgallery.com is her website. So iowahistory.org or oldcityhallgallery.com.
The State Historical Museum's curator, Leo Landis, and exhibits manager, Andrew Harrington. Rose Franson's Portrait of Maquoketa, The Dimensional View, opens on March 11th and continues through August 28th. The exhibit is free and open to the public. The Portrait of Maquoketa will also be on display this fall at the FIGI Art Museum starting on October 1st. To hear more from Rose Franson, Tim Schiffer, Leo Landis, and Andrew Harrington's interviews about Rose's career, her Portrait of Maquoketa project, and the State Historical Museum, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Just ahead, a guitarist with Aussie roots heads to Iowa. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. The Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society has invited New York-based Australian classical guitarist Rupert Boyd to perform as part of their concert series in early April. Rupert has three guitars. He owns a cheap beach guitar, but the other two are designed by Australian guitar makers, one of whom is considered by many to be one of the greatest guitar makers alive today, Rupert Boyd.
And his name is Greg Smallman, and he really revolutionized the way people made classical guitars. Starting off in the early 1980s, he's also a very eccentric character. He sort of one day said, I want to build a guitar, and did exactly that. And the second guitar he ever made, John Williams, the great classical guitarist, bought from him and has continued to play his guitars for the rest of his career. But so he sort of revolutionized the classical guitar by incorporating carbon fiber into the top of the instrument. So the top wood of the guitar is incredibly thin, but it's layered underneath with carbon fiber in a lattice brace structure, which just creates a much more resonant and loud sounding instrument. I guess one of the sort of weaknesses often of the Spanish classical guitar is that it can be fairly quiet. And so these Greg Smallman guitars are much sort of more louder and resonant, and really they're beautiful instruments to be able to play, because you can really sort of bring out melodic lines much better. But so I have the Greg Smallman guitar and also a guitar by his apprentice, whose name was Eugene Phelps.
Rupert fills us in on his recordings, upcoming recital, and musical background.
I started playing guitar 25 years ago when I was about 8 years old, and I was doing just a general music program at my elementary school. And one day they asked if I'd like to play an instrument, and I said I'd go home and think about it. And that exact same day, my brother came home from high school playing a guitar. And so I went back to my music teachers the next day saying, of course, you know, guitar is the best instrument in the world. That's what I want to play. And I think my brother sort of gave up about 2 weeks later. But 25 years later, here I am still plugging away. And I should also say that I did start the guitar when I was 8, but probably didn't really give it a lot of thought until I was 18 or so. And got to the end of high school and suddenly had to make a decision whether I wanted to study music at university or whether I wanted to do astronomy. It was my other big love at the time. And I think it was my guitar teacher who just convinced me by sort of being a very charming person and saying that, you know, music is just such an incredible life to have, that made me think about going to study music. Sort of haven't looked back. So I came to the United States then 11 and a half years ago. I did my undergraduate degree in Australia and came to the United States to do my master's degree at the Manhattan School of Music. And after that, I went on and did an artist diploma at Yale University, and then graduated from Yale in 2008 and have been just living the life as a freelance classical guitarist ever since.
And you're very active in both being a soloist and a chamber musician as well. And in fact, you're in a duo and have traveled around the world. Tell us a bit about that.
I believe it was Chopin who once said, nothing is nicer than one guitar except possibly two. And so I do have an ensemble called the Australian Guitar Duo. But the one thing that's a little bit complicated about it is that my duo partner, he lives in Barcelona. And so I'm living in New York City, and we tend to meet up once or twice throughout the year, either in Australia, which is where we both grew up, or sometimes in the States, sometimes in Europe. Or even the past couple of years, we've been to China and the Philippines and the west coast of Canada. And so that's really exciting. We, throughout the year, are performing our own sort of solo works and then sort of meet up. And we have this great tradition. We've been playing guitar together for coming on 16 years now. So even if we haven't seen each other for months, we can still get back together and very, very quickly get back into the duo together. But in addition to that, too, I also play in a duo with my wife, who is a cellist. Her name's Laura Metcalf. And definitely the guitar and cello is a wonderful combination. So we're playing some concerts together and have plans to record a CD together later this year.
Now, you do have a CD out already called Songs from the Forest. Tell us about that.
I actually have two CDs out. I have Songs from the Forest, which is with my ensemble, the Australian Guitar Duo. I also have a solo CD called Valses Poeticos, which is my absolute favorite guitar work that I could ever sort of think about. And so that's got some works by Granados and Piazzolla. With the Australian Guitar Duo, that CD is a really nice mix of contemporary Australian composition and then other just standard works. But the one thing that we feel very passionate about is playing works by Australian composers. Because there's a number in Australia who, maybe it's something in the water or something, but they're just writing like brilliant works for guitar and on the whole are not sort of known outside of Australia. So we have some beautiful pieces by Nigel Westlake, Philip Houghton, and Ross Edwards. And then sort of mix that up with just some Beatles songs, some Granados, and Scarlatti, and some other sort of just classical works. And then I also do have a brand new solo CD, which is to come out in April, I think just after my concert in Iowa. It was recorded in a beautiful little church just outside of London last November. There's a great record producer who lives in London, and he found this sort of wonderful church that we can set the microphones up on a Sunday evening and record through till Wednesday night. We spent like 3 full days just starting at about 11 a.m. and finishing at midnight, just recording in this beautiful sounding church that sort of dates back to the 15th century. And so that CD is called Fantasias, and that will be out in late April.
On Saturday, April 2nd, you're going to be appearing at the Capitol Hill Lutheran Church in Des Moines, and you're going to be there as part of the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society. So tell us, what are you going to be performing for your Des Moines audiences?
Well, I'll be playing some selections from my new CD, Fantasias. And I'm calling it that because it has 4 different fantasies on the CD. And the fantasy basically was a title the composers would use if they didn't know what else to call it. And so usually these composers, and the earliest examples of these are from like the early 16th century. So these composers would write a work where it was an exploration of their imagination. And so I, on the CD, have a fantasy by John Ballant, who is an English lutenist, who would have written this fantasy probably the very beginning of the 17th century. And then I also have a modern-day fantasy written by a Hawaiian composer called Byron Yasui. And it's a fantasy on a Hawaiian lullaby. And so it's got another one on the opera La Traviata, and has a fantasy by the 19th century guitarist Legnani. So I sort of intersperse these actual fantasies with other just works from around the world. And there's a couple of works by a wonderful Australian composer, Philip Houghton, also playing some Celtic folk songs. And just a real sort of a mixed bag, because the one thing about the guitar is that we struggle in that we don't have any works by the great composers like Beethoven and Brahms and Chopin and Rachmaninoff. We don't have works by them, so we have to instead go out and find newer works or sort of different works. And so I'll be playing a piece by Astor Piazzolla, who was a great tango composer, and then just sort of mixing that up and really exploring the real stuff of what it is possible to play on the classical guitar.
New York-based Australian classical guitarist Rupert Boyd. Rupert will perform on Saturday, April 2nd at 7:30 p.m. as part of the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's concert series. For more details, go to heartofiowaguitar.org. To hear more from Rupert's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Rupert also had a work written for him by composer John Franzen. Watch for his performance to appear soon on YouTube. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Courtney Jones, John Rapson, Randy Hogenkamp, Matthew Andrini, Rose Franzen, Tim Schiffer, Susan Caver, Andrew Harrington, Leo Landis, Jeff Morgan, and Rupert Boyd. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner and Phil Moss. Thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns and Sean McLean and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.